Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Smokey Barr, who spent 35 years officiating high school basketball, baseball, and football. But before we talk about enforcing rules of sport, we're going to explore the nature of rules themselves. Scott Samuelson is here. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College and author of the new book, Seven Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. Hello, Scott.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, of course, societies have developed rules, laws. Our laws are constantly evolving. But I want to start with something more fundamental than law, and that's the idea of a moral code or our ethics. When we look at philosophy and really the historical record, where did we first start seeing conversations about a moral code?
Well, it goes back about as far as our historical record exists. We think of like Hammurabi's code that goes real far back. Philosophers debate a little bit about where did this moral code come from. Sometimes people think that these were just fairly good principles to help people get by and flourish, and they became codified into moral principles and eventually moral laws. Other people, you know, think that they have a divine origin, or perhaps even there's just something that calls to us that goes beyond just our mere flourishing, that just says there's a right way of being that we have to respect and live by.
Well, and if you look at the writings of philosophers, can you separate religious philosophy or religious morals and ethics from the idea of a moral code?
I think it's difficult for a long time, but philosophers again have always tried to make something of a distinction. So on the one hand, there is this idea that the moral code is imposed by God in some ways, or the gods, or built into the structure of the universe. And the philosophers from very early on, I think of Socrates as being probably the most famous example, have asked the question of, well, are these moral principles simply based on the will of God, or is there some rationale to them? Even if God is somehow connected to these moral rules, does God have a rationale, or do these moral principles have a rationale that we could separate potentially from religion? Perhaps religion helps us to understand them, but do they have some logic to them, or is it just kind of an arbitrary fiat of God's there? In a way, I suppose this is a question that, you know, gets us into thinking about rules more generally. You know, when we first encounter rules, they seem like just rules. They seem like they've just been laid down for us and we don't quite know why we have to follow them. But a lot of times when we have more experience with the practice, we can start to understand why the rule is the way it is. And I think of philosophers as having tried to think through that. Why is the rule the way it is? Is this a good rule? If it's so, what is its rationale, and does it exist or can it exist without reference to God's command?
Which is a philosophical debate that we have on a daily basis in this country. I mean, it's one of those philosophical debates that I think is as old as time, but also fresh every day.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, and it's one that pertains to religion, but like I said, in a way, it goes even beyond just that. It has to do with authority. I mean, when we talk about the word rule, in some sense, we just mean someone who has power over us, or something that has power over us. So you could talk about a ruler, you know, a king or a god, and that we have to follow because of their power. But then, of course, we also have this idea of rules as things that we, like I said, we have a rationale for respecting. We talk about the rule of law and that sort of thing that has a human rationale to it. So, yeah, it goes for, you know, I suppose everything from religion and ethics to things like sports and grammar.
There are, you know, so many things that we consider to be fundamental to our society in the United States. And then you look at societies around the world, and although there are many, many similarities, there are some key differences as well. I mean, if you just think about this idea in the United States that is pretty hard and fast, that you marry just one person.
Mm-hmm.
and that's what a marriage is.
Right.
I mean, that's not something that's reflected in every society around the world. But we do like to think that our rules, our rules are the right ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. There's a famous story in the ancient Greek historian Herodotus where he was he came across a culture of people who, after someone died, they would actually eat the person to show respect for them. And then he also, of course, came across a group of people who would cremate the people when they died in order to show respect for them. And, you know, he had each group meet and he said, "What could I give you to switch your practices?" You know, and each group said, "That is barbaric what the other person does. The idea that you would eat the flesh of another being is the worst thing imaginable." And then the other group said, "The idea that you would light them on fire is the worst thing imaginable." And Herodotus concludes from that. He says, "Custom is king over all." It must be that, you know, we just get so accustomed to the kinds of principles we grew up with that they just seem natural to us and we can't imagine there being anything different.
Well, if we look at how rules develop, I mean, you mentioned earlier the idea that a moral code or ethics are the rules that help a society flourish. It's easy to also see that there could be some alternative rules mm-hmm. that could also help a society flourish.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And to me, I guess I'm not inclined to go down Herodotus's road completely and say that custom is totally king overall. I definitely think there's some truth in that we do get very accustomed to things. But I also think it's tremendously good for us all to travel, to mentally travel and study other cultures and peoples and see that things can be done differently. And sometimes to learn from that, to ask ourselves the question of, are our principles as good as they can be? Perhaps sometimes it's a matter of indifference, which, you know, side you put the fork on. But sometimes it can make a big difference. And sometimes we can learn from other cultures and become, I think, richer, better people ourselves for learning different rules and different ways of doing things.
Another philosophical debate that is incredibly relevant for our times and ongoing is about the purpose of law. Now, you mm-hmm. mentioned rulers. There was a time mm-hmm. when, you know, someone who had a great deal of power mm-hmm. invested in them could make up the rules
right.
for a culture. But of course, we have a democratic government and we have all of these lawmakers that are working together to create laws. But there's a lot of argument about what the purpose of those laws mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. So would give us an idea of some of the different takes on the purpose of laws.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very vexed question in political philosophy. The some of the older views that still many people agree with have the idea of that the purpose of law is to help us to flourish as human beings, that the purpose of law is to help us lead happy lives, the pursuit of happiness, to use the famous phrase from the Declaration of Independence. But there's a whole other tradition that's a fairly modern tradition that also informs us that says that it's not so much about our happiness. It's really just about laying down basic ground rules and respecting basic rights that we have, and law is there for that. Yet others might say it's just simply there for our safety. So it's an interesting question. There's a great American philosopher, John Rawls, who came up with a kind of thought experiment for what good rules would be. And in a way, the thought experiment's an interesting one. It reminds me of when I was a kid and a friend of mine and I would be wanting to split a candy bar. We had this rule where the person who split it could not choose
right.
which side they got, that the person who did not split the candy bar got to choose. And the idea was that kind of compelled us to split the candy bar as evenly and fairly as possible. And what Rawls says is that should be a kind of way we think about our rules overall. As he says, we should imagine ourselves as if we were, you know, maybe souls up in heaven and we were about to be born into our society, but we did not know who we were going to be born as. Maybe I'm going to be born as a male, maybe a female. Maybe I'll be born to a rich family or a poor family. I'll be born black or white. Maybe I'll be born gifted, or maybe I'll be born with certain challenges. And he says, you know, how would we want the rules to be? And he says, we would want them to be as fair as possible. We would want everyone to be respected. We wouldn't want to be tyrannized by others. But we would also want, we would be okay with some inequalities, he said, of wealth and whatnot, as long as it was benefiting everyone. So anyway, I mean, you know, there's just lots of different interesting approaches to these questions.
Right,
of,
which is clearly what all of our lawmakers are doing. Right?
Yeah. Well, I always wish that I could somehow make a rule that says you have to at least think about that thought experiment before you pass the law. But I don't know.
Because there are many laws that get passed. I mean, if the idea is to keep people safe, there are laws that might keep me safe, mm-hmm. but not someone else.
Correct. Yeah.
And when the preponderance of our lawmakers are white men or at least Caucasian people, mm-hmm. then there's bound to be inequity.
Sure. And it becomes very easy for us to rationalize deep unfairnesses. We can think that it's just fair based on our customs or because they're benefiting us. It becomes much harder when you're on the other side of that dilemma.
Well, you mentioned rules between friends. I mean, we have so many different kinds of rules in our cultures. You know, we have the rule of law, but we also have institutional rules,
right.
which, for example, school rules mm-hmm. don't necessarily have to be things that could be enforceable if they were law in mm-hmm. a culture. We have more rules that govern children than govern adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really almost think that you can't totally do without rules at some level. I mean, but you're quite right to say that there are just a whole variety of different kinds of rules that, like I said, we can talk about the rules of just, you know, speaking a language or the rules of a school or sometimes we can talk about unspoken rules that exist, you know, among peoples. Part of the beauty of friendship is perhaps you need the fewest number of rules to be with your friends.
Yeah, hopefully. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about rules, where they come from, why we need them, enforcing rules. We're taking a philosophical approach at the moment with Scott Samuelson, professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College and author of the new book, 7 Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. And you're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about rules and rule keepers. Coming up in a little while, I'll talk with Smokey Barr, who spent 35 years officiating high school basketball, baseball, and football. Right now with me is Scott Samuelson, professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College and author of the new book, 7 Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. And a little later on, Scott, we're going to talk about sports. Now, that's a world where we get to make up rules, and mm-hmm. sometimes the rules are incredibly complicated. But once the rules are set for a given sport, I mean, that's law. Mm-hmm. We'll talk with Smokey about enforcing those rules. But it's kind of an interesting experiment with rules. What do you think we learn about when we follow the rules of sports?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, first thing to say, of course, though, is this, that the rules of sports do change and people do argue about, is this a good rule or not? And at times, you know, so the idea is even with those rules, we have a sense of something higher that these rules are trying to serve. And yet at the same time, it's true, they can be a bit arbitrary. But I mean, I personally think of sports as being a really wonderful way of cultivating parts of our character. It isn't to say that all athletes, of course, are going to be, you know, stellar human beings. But you know, I think we all have these competitive tendencies in us and these drives and powerful things in us. And putting them in the context of sports, I actually think can be incredibly, helpful to developing us. And in part, because we have to learn to respect rules and respect the enforcement of those rules and respect others in relationship to those rules. So, you know, the fact that sports have these rules and that it's so important for us to respect them, that we can't win at all costs. We have to win within the context of the rules or strive to do our best in the context of those rules. That seems to me an important lesson for all of us to work on.
Do you think it's part of how kids learn how rules work, how laws work?
Yeah, well, I think it can be. There's some really hard lessons to learn that I don't know. Like when it comes to sports, it seems like we always tell our kids at least two things. One is we always say, try your best. And then the second is we always say, it's just a game. Those are two very hard lessons to learn. They seem to be at odds with each other mm-hmm. at some level, because the it's just a game is saying you shouldn't cry if you lose. You know, you should just enjoy the sport for what
right,
it is.
But if you give it your all, you're really making a commitment.
Right. But if you give it your all, and I don't think that they ultimately do cancel each other out, but to be able to learn that we need to strive our best in life to do things as well as we can, but also understand that we ultimately don't get to make the rules or even decide who wins or loses, that's out of our hands. You know, those are hard lessons to deeply learn, and kids struggle with that. You see them all the time, you know, crying after games, but you see the same thing with us adults.
Right.
So I think it can help us along that way. I'm sure it's not the only way to do it, but it's certainly one powerful way.
Well, and we have there's a lot of pressure to win when you play any given sport, really. But there's also this sort of fundamental idea that if you cheat to win, that negates
right, exactly.
the power of winning.
Right.
It's not worth it.
Exactly. No, I think that's exactly right. So step one is you want to win within the rules. And step two, I think, ultimately is that idea of you really do. Well, we also say, you know, it's not whether you win or lose. It's how you play the game. And I think that's kind of the highest level to get to actually be able to just delight in the competition itself or delight in the game itself, even beyond the winning and losing, you know, to be able to go up against, a great competitor and lose to them, but feel like, wow, I would rather lose to this competitor because it's allowed me to play my best.
Right.
That seems the highest level, hard to reach, but I think we can sometimes get to that level.
Well, in our society, of course, we have laws, and sometimes when those laws are enforced, people feel like they're not being enforced fairly. So
right.
we have people to protect against that as well. And one of those people is joining us right now. Christy
Great.
Hirschman is Iowa State Ombudsman. The Ombudsman's Office is an impartial and nonpartisan fact finder for complaints about state and local government. Hello, Christy.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And for people who've never had an opportunity to interact with your office, give me an example of what you do. What would someone come to you for?
Well, 44% of our complaints come from inmates either in the jail or prison system. And so they might contact us and say they thought a disciplinary report was unfair or due process wasn't followed or excessive use of force happened when they were restrained. We get complaints, excessive use of force complaints also against police departments. We get complaints that the city won't pave my street or the county won't rock my road. We get complaints, Department of Human Services took my children. I'm not getting my food stamps, all types of complaints like that against state and local government.
So when someone comes to you and with a complaint, what's your process? Because obviously you have to try to be impartial and figure out what's happened in this situation.
Correct. First, we determine whether the issue is jurisdictional to us. Second, we determine if they have an available either formal or informal appeal process that they can use to resolve the problem before we get involved. Sometimes we say, well, did you contact the city council? Well, no. Well, that's the first step you need to take before we get involved in determining whether your problem has merit. And then if we agree that there's a problem, or we agree to review the problem and investigate, then we look at law, rule, and policy and determine whether we agree the agency is violating either law, rule, or policy or being unreasonable or unfair. And then we try and persuade the agency to correct the problem.
How do you make sure that this is an impartial process? Because, of course, you've got individuals working in the office who are going to have their own personal biases. Trying to be impartial and nonpartisan is an extremely challenging thing to do.
There's a lot of self-checking that goes on in our office amongst each of us do it, and then amongst each other. And then as a manager, it's my responsibility, I feel, to review the cases that my staff are working on to confirm that their answers were appropriate and that there was no bias involved in their response.
Do you have a process to help people understand their biases that they may not be aware of?
We've gone through training. We've had training occasionally. I serve on the board of directors for the United States Ombudsman's Association, and at the national level, we have training also on bias to recognize that bias. I have a very good group of staff right now, and they're very aware of what their biases are. And on occasion, we have to reassign cases just because a person, has developed a bias, and so it can be handled by someone who doesn't have that bias, either for or against either the complainant or the agency itself.
Now, you mentioned earlier that if somebody hasn't followed the correct appeals process, or going to the local government or whatever institution they're having problems with, they need to start there. Do you have people coming to you who just feel that whatever rule is being enforced is fundamentally unfair?
Oh, yes, most definitely. And in those cases, we refer them, especially if it's in the Iowa Code, we refer them to their legislator to try and get the rule changed. Now, if it's internal rule or policy, and I'll use the Department of Corrections as an example, if they have an internal policy that we believe is unfair, then we can try and persuade the agency to correct that problem, or update the policy or revise the policy.
The stakes are very high with a lot of the things that you need to deal with. How do you cope with that? That must be extremely stressful.
It is. One of the questions when we interview employees, prospective employees to work in our office, one of the questions I always ask is how they handle stress both inside, both professionally and personally. Sometimes by the time people get to us with their complaint, they've been bounced around between agencies, or they've been bounced around within an agency, or been told different answers and are quite frustrated. And then they're referred to us by someone who says, the ombudsman can help you. And then in those situations where we can't help them because it's not jurisdictional or their complaint doesn't have merit, they are really angry. And, it's important that we understand that not to take it personally, the attacks and the anger that some people share with us during their phone calls or in their communications.
Can you give me an example of a case where your decision has been key in reversing a decision that had been made before or really making a change?
Well, we've done some major public critical reports involving the lottery, that was a long time ago, 2000 already, the death of Shelby Duez in Northwest Iowa, where we made recommendations regarding changes in that particular case in the child abuse investigation system. The lottery, we made some recommendations about stronger enforcement as it relates to store clerks buying lottery tickets. A lot of what we do, however, is behind the scenes, and we had a case that was highlighted in our annual report this year. Again, it's a Department of Prison case involving the use of a canine in extracting an inmate from a cell in a situation, and as a result of our inquiry and discussion with the prison, a number of policy changes were made, so that won't happen again in the future.
Chrissy, where did you get interested in this kind of process? Did you naturally have kind of an interest in enforcing rules or understanding governance?
No. When I was hired over 22 years ago, they were looking for somebody with small business experience that would help small businesses as it relates to permitting and rules and those type of situations. And it's just evolved for me personally. On my staff, I have a number of attorneys who are good at, you know, reviewing the law and helping people. I have three former newspaper reporters, and they're very good at investigating and getting down to the bottom of things. One former law enforcement officer. So we have a variety of people in the office, and it's important that my staff is patient and that they have a passion to help people when they do identify a problem.
Christy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're most welcome.
Christy Hirschman, Iowa's state ombudsman. We're talking about rules this hour and rule keepers. Scott Samuelson is with us, a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College, author of the new book, Seven Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. Now, Christy brings up an important point about our rules in our culture and our rules of law, which is that people don't tend to be really great at self-governance. There does have to be oversight. There has to be a system in place to make sure that the rules are enforced fairly.
Yeah, I mean, right. This is the importance, I suppose, of the referees in our society.
Whatever kind of referees they may be.
Whatever kind of referee they may be, but it is a it's an absolutely crucial thing. And I mean, so on the one hand, you have the very difficult job of trying to apply rules fairly, and that itself is incredibly important. That seems to be deeply embedded in human nature, that we want the rules at least to be applied as fairly as they can be. But then, of course, we have the question of, are these fair rules to begin with?
Let's look at the rules of the Jim Crow South.
Right.
There were a lot of rules, and
exactly.
They were enforced, but they were fundamentally unfair.
Correct. Yeah. And I mean, and this has been another longstanding philosophical question, is that there is this deep tension that we have between, on the one hand, we all should respect the rules that govern our lives because they make our lives possible. We should respect the law. But at the same time, the law can be deeply unfair at times. And then the question is, what do you do in those circumstances? I mean, ideally, you do what was just being described, which is, you know, you try to change the system within the rules themselves and hopefully make them as fair as they can be. But yeah, that's the difficult thing. Rules can get, you know, rules aren't always good. That's for sure. We need them, but they can be very destructive and unjust.
Well, and there are two very different schools of thought about, you know, if rules aren't good, there are the people who will say, then we need more rules, mm-hmm. and we'll change the rules and we'll make them better. But then we also have the other side of that coin, people saying, well, if you can't make good rules, we need fewer rules. We need to give people the freedom to live by their own moral code.
Right. Yeah, I guess I kind of want to take some in-between position there, which is that certainly I think freedom is very important. And up to a point, freedom does mean not having to follow a rule or not being governed precisely. But at the same time, I think real freedom has to have some rules around it. So to me, the question is, what are the rules that best promote our freedom? Not should we have rules or should we have freedom?
In thinking about some of the philosophers that you study, I mean, some of them were very well known for pushing the boundaries
right.
of rules in their own cultures. What can we learn from that? I mean, Socrates himself was a bit of a rule breaker.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Socrates is an interesting case because, well, he's famously charged with unholiness and corrupting the youth, essentially breaking the rules of Athens and encouraging others to break the rules of Athens. And Socrates does say in his defense, he says, look, you know, I'm serving something higher here. And sometimes that means that perhaps rules have to be broken. But then he's put in prison and he's going to be executed and someone gives him a chance to try to escape. But he says, well, at some level, we do have to respect these rules. They've made us who we are. I kind of learned from him a lesson of almost civil disobedience, which is to say, we should follow the rules even when we disagree with them because they are so important to us. But if we deeply, deeply disagree with them and think that they're totally unjust, perhaps we do have a right to break them. But we should probably break them publicly and be willing to take a punishment for them. It's in a way almost a criterion of moral seriousness. It's one thing to break a rule and try to get away with it, mm-hmm. which really is just a criminal, versus the kind of person like a Rosa Parks who breaks a rule. But of course, when the police come, she says, in essence, yes, you should arrest me. I broke the law. The law is a bad law. But, you know, I'm doing this to try to draw attention
civil
to that and change it. Yeah.
Although many people would also argue that, and Rosa Parks is not an example of this, but some of us have a privilege that protects us in cases of civil disobedience,
right.
whereas others do not have that privilege that protects them, and it could cost them everything.
Correct. And there may be times when it does make sense, you know, to try to get away. I mean, I guess a famous case of that now is someone like an Edward Snowden. A lot of people think of his violating the law as being a good thing, an important thing, but rather than do it in a civil disobedient manner, he fled the country. Maybe that makes sense. I don't know. It's certainly a morally vexed question, but I at least think we should be wrestling with that
right.
question and not thinking that we can just break the law whenever we disagree with it.
Well, thanks for helping us wrestle with some of these questions today, Scott.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Scott Samuelson is a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College. He's also the author of the new book, Seven Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. We'll have to have you back to talk about that in the very near future. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We'll continue in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Now we're going to focus on rules of the game or games. Roger Barr, better known as Smokey, spent 35 years enforcing sports rules. He officiated Iowa high school basketball, baseball, and football. This summer, he'll be inducted into the National Federation of High School Associations Hall of Fame. And we're going to talk about calling the shots courtside and witnessing the evolution of sport. Smokey's on the line with us. Hi, Smokey.
Hey, good morning. How are you today, Charity?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I want to take you way back in time to when you first started working as an official. How did that start?
Well, I started officiating. A gentleman that worked for the United States Postal Department came to my store, the store where I was working, and he said, I need a basketball partner. My basketball partner moved to the East Coast, and I have a full schedule of basketball games. And he said, I need a partner. And he said, you're going to be my partner. And I said, oh, I don't think so. And it took about two or three different conversations for him to convince me to do it. My father officiated for years, was a three-sport official as well. So I had some background in it, I guess, to a certain extent. And I played high school football, basketball, and baseball, and then played college baseball. So I had the player's perspective, but I'm not sure I really had the official's perspective. And so he finally convinced me to do it. And when I did, I thought, oh, Lord, what am I getting into here? And but I got into it, and it became a passion, and I really, really loved every bit of it.
So you started out in basketball, and did you start specifically in girls basketball?
Well, it was boys and girls
okay.
because most of the schools back then all played a doubleheader. They played the girls' game first, and then they played the boys'
oh,
game.
Oh, wow. And but, you, of course, you, those games were very different because the boys were playing 5-on-5 and the girls were playing 6-on-6, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely, and that made it a little more difficult because some of the positioning that they used as an official, whether you were between the girl and the basket or on the outside of the girl, you know, depended on which way you were going down the floor, if you were staying in the front court, and boys was a little bit different, and that was probably one of the hardest things for me. Every time we'd have a timeout, he'd come over and say, now, when you have the ball in the front court and you're going to stay in the front court in this girl's game, you need to be between the girl and the basket. And I'm thinking, well, in the boys, I'm on the opposite side. Yep, you are, but in the girls, and so I thought, wow, am I ever going to get this down or not? But it just went into place as you continued to work.
So when you first started officiating 6-on-6 girls basketball, you had not even watched a 6-on-6 girls basketball game before, had you?
That's correct. I mean, I might have seen, you know, bits and pieces on TV maybe, but our high school didn't have girls basketball at that time, and so I wasn't familiar with six-player basketball at all, so it was a foreign object to me. But
right, how did you learn the game to be an official before you'd really even watched it?
Well, I'm sure I was pretty rough around the edges, to say the least, but I started right out working varsity games, and you broke in. I can tell you about probably about the third or fourth night I worked in girls basketball and six player basketball. Of course, you had three forwards and three guards. Well, when they made a basket, the girls would wheel around and run back to the center line because the person, we would throw the ball to the other official, he would bounce it to the girl in the center court, and then she could throw it to back court or into front court, either way. Well, the reason they raced back up there was to play defense in their back court against a forward from the other court so they couldn't throw the ball back. They wanted to defend that, so they had to throw it in the front court. Well, I couldn't figure out why they raced up to the line, and I took the ball out of the cylinder and threw it to my partner, and I didn't get enough loft on it, and I hit a girl right in the side of the head.
Oh.
And, oh, I felt so terrible, you know, and the coach is out there, that's my best girl, and I'm going, I am so sorry, you know, and I kept saying to myself, why is she racing back to the line up there? She just made a basket at this end. They aren't going to get the ball until they play down to the other end. But you learn to put a little loft on the ball, and those are things that, oh, wow, you just think, oh, man, am I doing the right thing here? Should I be doing this? But as time went on, you just learned the game. You know, you studied the rules. I think that was probably the most important thing for me, is to get into the rule book and study the rules. And that's what I did for both the boys and the girls basketball, because playing the game and officiating the game are two different things when you really get down to it.
So now you were kind of pressed into service as an official, but at some point, clearly this became a real passion of yours. Why? Why do you think it was something that you felt so strongly about?
Well, you know, I've always been kind of one of those people that I've always kind of needed something to do. You know what I mean? Downtime for me was never good. I just always had to have something to do. And I took it on as a challenge. I'll be real honest. I took every night, every game as a challenge. How good can I be? Can I be my best and give 110% every night and work for the kids and work for the coaches? You know, the coaches dedicate a lot of time and put a lot of time and effort into these kids, and the kids put a lot of time and effort in. These kids today, you know, a lot of them just are one-sport players. Unfortunately, I'd like to see them all play a lot of sports, and there's a lot of them that do, but some of these kids just play one sport, and they just, you know, they hone in on that, and they're really good at what they do, and I put that out as a challenge to myself, as every night, how good can I be? And by no means did I work any perfect game ever, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the kids. I enjoyed the coaches. And the friendships that I made with not only players but coaches and athletic directors and all the people involved to make all those games happen was the highlight of what I did.
Now, as you're in that role as an official, you're working extremely hard. You have to be very, very alert and stay on your game all the time. But when you do your job really well, you're not going to get a pat on the back for the most part. I mean, the people who are there in the stands only care when you mess up, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of true to that point, you know. But, you know, you do, and you're going to make mistakes, and you know it. You know, if you made one, you know it when you've made it. But I always used to try and tell officials when I went to work for the Iowa High School Athletic Association, when I went out, I used to tell them, be honest, be fair, and if you make a mistake, tell the coach, hey, coach, I missed that one. You know, they're going to have a lot more trust in you, and your integrity will build if you're honest and fair with those people. And that's what I tried to do. I went by a coach one night, and he said, Smokey, I think you missed that one. And I said, stick around. I'm going to miss some more before the night's over. And he was still laughing when I went back by him, you know. But, yeah, you just go out. And I always tell officials, like I said, be honest, be fair, work hard. And when you're done and you come in and you look in that mirror, there's only one person you got to answer to, and that's yourself. And if you can say, hey, I did a great job, you can go home, put your head on a pillow, and sleep comfortably that night.
Now, you, in your career, saw a lot of changes in high school athletics. I mean, let's talk about girls basketball for just a moment. You were actually one of the officials at the very last 6-on-6 game played in Iowa, right, back in 1993.
Yep, I did. I was fortunate enough to be selected to work the last six-player championship game, and what an honor it was. I mean, I never dreamed that I would get that honor, but it was a very humbling and very very nice honor. And we had about 14,000 some people in Vets Auditorium, and it was fun. It was Hubbard Radcliffe and Atlantic. I can still remember that game today. Yep.
What are some of the other changes that you witnessed from the court, from the sidelines, from the football field? What did you see change during your career?
Well, I think in credit to the Iowa High School Athletic Association and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union, both bodies there really went to support of sportsmanship. And I think we were very fortunate in Iowa to have great leaders in both of those associations. Bernie Sago was there. Rick Woka was there. E-Wayne Cooley was there. Bob Smiley in the girls' office. E-Wayne Cooley in the girls' office. Those people all backed up and supported good sportsmanship, and I think they got it out to our schools and got them to support our good sportsmanship on the floor and off the floor. And I think our schools, went with that program and they developed that program in their schools. And I think it made our job a lot easier on the floor as officials because the kids were expected to, to behave. It's not that we didn't have an occasion or two where we had to set some things straight, but that's something I thought both associations, the Athletic Association and the Girls Union, did a super job of doing. And our coaches and our athletic directors, like I said, they took with that and ran with that sportsmanship because it was important for our kids to show good sportsmanship and be leaders out there and be the kind of people that, you're never going to play the game for the rest of your life. And now you're going to get out and learn about what life's all about. And there's always ups and downs in life, as we all well know. But learning to be a good sport and a good person is integrity and honesty and fairness. Those things all play a role. And I think those things were one of the big changes that we had over the years that really helped credit our game in football, basketball, and baseball, and wrestling, and track, and golf, and tennis, and all the activities that we have. And not only just the athletics, but I think all of our fine arts and everything. I mean, they saw sportsmanship posters all over in their school. And I think those things really make a difference in the character. I can tell you, I've been around a lot of different states and been dealt with a lot of different people from different state offices. And I've dealt with a lot of coaches. And a lot of coaches say to me, we love the Iowa kids. They had good work ethic. They were good people, and they were good students. And those are things that we don't always get everywhere. And so I think it made Iowa proud for those accomplishments.
Now, it's one thing for the kids to have strong sportsmanship skills, for the coaches. How about the parents? How did you see that change during your career? You retired in 2002, so maybe things have changed even more since then. But did you have problems with parents not respecting your calls?
Well, you're going to have a few in throughout the times, but I really can't say that I had much trouble with the parents, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm sure there were some parents that were not happy when I worked some nights, you know what I mean, or a game or two. But I always remember a parent coming to me one I think it was about the first year I retired, and they came to me and said, you worked two of our sons and one of our daughters. And the thing that I always liked was they said, you didn't get every call right, I can tell you that. And I said, I'm sure I didn't. And he said, but one thing about it, you're always fair, whether we played at home or we played on the road. And that meant a lot to me. I mean, I said, that's the nicest compliment you can give me. And I think for the most part, I really didn't have much trouble with parents. But there's always sometimes a few that go around that have to get their words in, and that's okay. I I just tried to block that out. I didn't worry about that. I just tried to do my job. And I think that as an official is something you just have to do, because if you start listening to them, then you aren't concentrating on what you should be doing. And so from that perspective, I had very little problem with parents.
Now, as I mentioned, as an official, there aren't a whole lot of accolades. You work evenings, weekends, you travel a lot as well, and there seems to always be a shortage of officials. So what makes it worthwhile, and what would you say to somebody to try to convince them to give it a try?
Oh, a lot of these young men and women have played sports in high school and some of them in college. And it's a good way to stay around the game is to go out and officiate, because you can stay close to the game. It's a good way to keep in shape. I mean, you run a lot in basketball and out in the football field and the baseball or softball diamonds. It's a good way to stay. And if you enjoy kids, that's where you need to be. That's where you need to be. And we do have a nationwide shortage. It's not just Iowa. Every state in the nation is talking about a shortage. I know when I left our office, our average official was probably 50 or a little above. And the problem I saw at the office when I left the Iowa High School Athletic Association was the colleges, the officials there are getting older. And they're coming down and scooping the younger officials up. And so if we had a young official get started and get going, first thing you know, the colleges were after them because they wanted to bring them into their game and put them in their game. So we lost them at the high school level for the most part, because a lot of them went to the collegiate level. And there's a lot of them that still work both high school and college, but there's just not enough people showing interest in officiating. And obviously, you know as well as I do, we have a lot of games played, a lot of nights in the state of Iowa, and those games all have to be covered by somebody working those ball games, and there's a definite need. But you know, the sense of just going out and working and saying you had fun, I enjoyed it, and that's what you want to do, and I did the best job I could do. And I think that, to me, I just developed a passion for the game. I told Ben, I said, I look forward to working. I'd go to work. We owned a sporting goods store, and I used to call on about 85 high schools, and I'd go out and call on the high schools during the day, so I may drive up to 150, 200 miles in the day and then come home, pack my bag, and take off and go officiate. And I did that a lot of nights, sometimes five and six nights a week. But I could hardly wait for that game to come around that night. I just had a passion for it. And I think if you get into officiating, you develop a passion and a love for the game, a love for working with the kids and the coaches, and see how good you can be. And if you go out and work every night like it's a championship game, you know what? You're going to be successful.
Well, Smokey, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You bet. Thanks for having me on, and best of luck to you.
Roger Barr, better known as Smokey, spent 35 years officiating high school basketball, baseball, and football in Iowa. This summer, in July, he'll be inducted into the National Federation of High School Associations Hall of Fame. Quite an honor. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.